please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-1498, Hamilton v. Hamilton. Arguing for petitioner respondent David Hamilton, Rebecca A. Copeland. Arguing for respondent petitioner Dorinda Hamilton, Peter Van Nameser. Also appearing for the respondent petitioner Dorinda Hamilton, Michael S. Zola. Arguing on the merits.
All right. Good afternoon, counsel. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right. Ms. Copeland, you'll go first. My understanding is you reserve 5 minutes in rebuttal. Then Mr. Esser, you will go, and we will give you a warning with 5 minutes left to go in your argument. Is that your understanding? Very well. Please proceed, Ms. Copeland.
When David initially received the inheritance, the earliest date was 2007, he deposited it into the separate agency account in which he kept the inheritance exclusively separate and segregated. During that time, he didn't manage it with any marital assets or effort. And so at the date of divorce, there was some inheritance monies, approximately $2 million, that were left in that separate segregated account at the time of the divorce.
So what you mean when you say it's kept segregated the entire time, it was segregated until it was taken out?
Well, the approximately $2 million that was left at the divorce wasn't ever taken out. There were some funds, approximately $1.4 million, that were used during those last 2.5 years to benefit the marital partnership. Those funds were taken out of the separate account and then used as part to benefit the marital partnership, which is why the court allocated to David a capital contribution credit in the amount of monies that he had used to benefit the partnership.
Were they used exclusively for that purpose?
The funds...
The $1.4 million. Does the record show that they were used exclusively for the benefit of the marital partnership, or were there other purposes too?
Yes, Your Honor. The record shows that he used it for various partnership benefits, buying the Kahala Cottage, which was marital partnership property, fixing up his Camaro, which was also marital partnership property. Dorinda got some dental work. He used it for normal family expenses as well, and trips that were taken by the parties during that last 2.5 years.
What about taxes on the inheritance?
I know that issue came up in the briefing, and when I looked back over the record, the CPA, Kuba, actually testified at the trial that they didn't go so far as to determining the character of the tax payments, and I think that supports the family court's ultimate decision because there was some conflicting evidence back and forth, and it's the family court's discretion to resolve that conflict that the entire amount was used to the benefit of the marital.
You would agree that if it had been used just to pay inheritance taxes for the inheritance which remained his marital separate property, would that money properly be counted as a contribution towards or being used towards the family? If that $400,000 was used to pay inheritance taxes, would that be an error to include that in the $1.4 million?
I think for that limited amount, that may have been an error, but again, the evidence was conflicting as to that, and at least Kuba, who was the expert designated for those purposes, testified that that characterization didn't go that far. Even if that small amount of money was properly considered in that regard, though, there large amount of capital contribution credit that David was still entitled to under the partnership model for the amount of monies that he had spent toward the partnership.
So it's your position that anything that was spent on the family is a capital contribution?
Correct, and that's actually the way that this court's case law and the partnership model itself delineates the different characteristics in the five categories and the three categorizations of, which include the marital separate property and the marital personal property.
Is that what our law says? I mean, doesn't our law say we follow the partnership model if money is invested in a partnership? So is it your argument that anytime somebody spends money, if you spend the money to go to lunch or you spend the money for whatever you wish, that it's suddenly equivalent to an investment in a partnership?
I think I understand your concern, but in this context and the way the various categories are defined, I think that might be a distinction without a difference, only because the term investment refers to the marital partnership as a whole, and the partnership model itself is actually designed to provide that predictable framework without that sort of tracing. So we don't require the family court to go into the various tracing of how different monies, whether it's inheritance or any other monies used during the marital partnership, to be allocated to a different dinner or if somebody gets their hair done and somebody doesn't. And so, you know, the partnership model itself creates that framework where we don't have those kind of tracing issues.
Would partnership law say that? Let's suppose I'm a non-marital, regular partnership, and I decide that I like roses every day in my office, or I like going to a fancy lunch every day. I mean, does every single expenditure that a person expends during a partnership, that's equivalent to investment? Is that what we're saying?
I think the way the general partnership model is set up is that, yes, all of the assets and liabilities that are gathered by a marital couple during the term of the marriage are considered marital partnership property as that general category. And whether you're terming it spending by one or the other or an investment by one or the other, I mean, that as a whole is the purpose behind the partnership model, so that we have these general categories. And then it's up to the family court's discretion on how to take into consideration a just and equitable division of that joint effort, both assets and liabilities.
I want to come back to the issue of taxes. The family court's order simply said that the monies were used to, quote, to pay taxes, end quote. Is that an actual resolution of the, as you imply, that the monies were used to pay marital taxes or taxes that they had as a married couple as opposed to taxes on his inheritance? Is that actually a finding that we can even interpret in that way? There's no doubt it was used to pay taxes. The question is taxes for what? And it doesn't say taxes for what.
And if that's a strong concern of the court, then the resolution to that would be to remand to the family court to make a determination. And it would be up to the family court to then maybe clarify whether or not those taxes were used exclusively for inheritance tax purposes or actually to benefit the marital partnership property itself.
In this case, the trial court ruled before trial, granted summary judgment that the $1.5 million was spent for marital purposes, and he was entitled to be repaid for that.
Correct. Yes.
And so the trial court, even without hearing any testimony, decided that the husband was entitled to be repaid this money, whether or not it was a gift.
That's correct as to the family court's ruling on the capital contribution credit. But
and as a practical matter, the husband only requested an $895,000 capital contribution credit. Is that correct?
Yes.
But so the trial court said you spent $101.5 million from your inherited funds, and therefore you're entitled to be credited for that entire amount, no matter for what purpose it was kept. Well, I think that the family court's justification behind that was its independent review of the evidence and its application of the governing law.
He ruled before trial without hearing any evidence, without hearing any of the evidence from the wife, for example, saying he never said he wanted the money back for the private school tuition or for the private college expenses. He offered her cosmetic surgery, and she said, no, I prefer to have a new smile. And even before trial, the judge ruled that none of this was a gift to the marital estate or to the other spouse.
Correct.
No genuine issues of material fact.
And he ruled that there was no donative intent as well related to the gift itself.
Because he had ruled pre-trial that there was no donative intent, and basically said we don't really need evidence on that issue.
Well, I think his decision in the findings was actually that she hadn't met her burden, so he did consider her arguments and the evidence that she presented related to the issue of the gift, and he found that she didn't actually meet her burden to show that there had been a donative intent, and David himself testified, contrary to obviously her testimony, that he didn't intend for it to be a gift to her.
You know, talking about this 1.5 that the judge said that was going to be characterized as a capital contribution, you know, does the wife in this situation, I mean, he decides, for example, that he's going to spend money on schools, he's going to elevate their standard of living. Does she have any control of it? Does she have any input? I mean, he decides, I've just inherited all this money, and I want to elevate our lifestyle, and does she have any control or input on any of this?
I think under the partnership model, regardless of how much each partner contributes, whether it's asset-wise or whether it's, for example, taking care of the kids, I mean, that partnership model itself.
So it doesn't matter. Right, so it doesn't matter what she wants, what she knows. All that matters is that he decides, I'm going to expend the money. Let me ask one follow-up question because it relates to this. So he inherits all this money, and he said, you know, there's really no reason to work anymore because I have all this money. So I can stop working, okay? And if I worked, the money I make goes into the joint marriage. But if I don't work, okay, I can expend as much money as I want. And guess what? She has to pay him back for him not working. Or am I wrong?
Respectfully, that's not the situation.
I'm asking you under the scenario that would be, under the way you look at this capital contribution, any money expended, she's going to be responsible to pay back.
He would be entitled to the capital contribution for the money that was expended, but the family court would still have discretion to deviate from the partnership model if that were the evidence and if that were the case, to make the distribution then more equitable.
What if the family court decided not to deviate?
Well, I think that's within the family court's discretion. That's why they are boots on the ground, listening to all the testimony, considering the evidence that's presented.
If you go by general partnership principles, though, you know, I think all of our cases so far have been based on the assumption that there was a gain. Part of general partnership law, I forget which statute, I think it's 425.123 or something like that, also says that after dissolution of a general partnership, each general partner is responsible to the other for the liabilities of the partnership. Right. So therefore, what we could have is situations just as such as what Justice Pollard just said, that someone inherits a lot of money, spends it all, and then says, you know, I never intended to give it, now you pay me back.
Well, and again, I think that's where the court's discretion comes in, and that's the discretion that the court exercised in this case. So even under general partnership law, the partners share in both the assets and the debts of the partnership. What the family court did in this situation then, because the value of the marital partnership itself was so modest compared to the amount of the capital contribution, and it created that negative mathematical amount, is it then allocated that 50-50 among the partners and then gave her the benefit of the deviation so that she
wasn't. Even though he didn't ask for it, even for the $605,000 that he never even asked for, the trial court allocated as a capital contribution, which she was 50%
responsible. Right, because under the partnership law, he was entitled to the amounts that he had in the family court's analysis of the evidence had expended toward the marital partnership itself.
What was included in the 895, by the way? I couldn't figure that out from the record.
I don't have the exact figures, but it was the things that I had listed earlier, the private school tuition, the trips that they took, the dental work for the wife. He did testify that he paid normal expenses because at the time, again, neither one of them were being in substantial.
Did he testify that I expected her to pay back for the dental work? He never testified to that. He testified as to the private school tuition that he expected it to be equalized during the marriage when she got her inheritance. That she was.
But that testimony was somewhat disputed. That is the testimony as to what the intent was of the expenditure of the $1.4 million. If I could ask your help on this concept, Ms. Copeland, about the manner in which the trial judge treated, as Justice McKenna was talking about, treated the payment almost up front before the trial as something other than a gift. Now, in Wong versus Wong, there is a proposition discussed that has to do with the presumption of gift. I think language is, in the case of close kinship, the presumption that a gift was intended, a presumption must be rebutted by clear and convincing evidence. So here we have a close kinship. You might say that the presumption arises that a gift was occurring, and then the rebuttal has to be by clear and convincing evidence. And there does seem to be disputed evidence in terms of testimony in the record about what the intent was of this expenditure, but the actual circumstances would suggest that perhaps it was something that was intended as a gift given the nature of the expenditure, right, on things such as private school, for example. And there wouldn't appear to be a consistent record of accounting by the husband suggesting that the expenditures were all supposed to be paid back. So I'm asking you how you would respond to the notion that perhaps a presumption should have at least been addressed by the trial court as to whether this, in fact, was a gift given the close kinship, and whether that analysis by the trial judge should have been under a clear and convincing standard.
I think my response to that, there's several responses. The first is that to the extent there was that conflicting evidence, it was within the family court's discretion to make a decision as to which of that conflicting evidence.
Do we know if clear and convincing standard was applied to that analysis as to the presumption that arises pertaining to a gift?
We don't have that in the findings of fact. We have the family court finding that she hadn't met her burden on the donative intent aspect of the three essential elements of the gift.
Ms. Copeland, if it's conflicting evidence, why doesn't it, shouldn't it be resolved at trial?
Correct.
Isn't it a question of fact?
Yes, and that's what the family court did, in its discretion.
If the court decided that, I thought the court decided at a pretrial level that the Mrs. Hamilton didn't meet the presumption of donate, or overcome the presumption of donative intent. Didn't you say that? Wasn't that a pretrial?
I don't actually recall if that was a pretrial finding. I know that it's in his findings of fact that she didn't meet that burden, and there was testimony at trial back and forth as to whether or not she claimed it was a gift and his testimony that he didn't intend it to be a gift.
The court granted a pretrial motion to strike the defense or argument that the defendant wasted Category 3 assets by spending money on items not related to the marriage.
Correct.
And ruled that the defendant was entitled to everything back. Pretrial, although he received a little bit of evidence on it, but he had ruled pretrial that all that 1.5 was going back into.
And would you characterize that as a determination pretrial that the expenditure of the inheritance was actually separate marital property? Or would you characterize it as just marital property, the expenditure, the 1.5?
Oh, the expenditure. Once David withdrew the money from the inheritance account, which he did keep separate and pristine, the amount of monies that he then withdrew and used toward the marriage, that was then characterized as marital partnership property, such that he was entitled to the capital contribution credit.
And at that point, it was not separate marital property.
Correct. That amount of monies that he had used toward the marital
partnership. In other words, it wouldn't be a Category 3 asset.
Well, the five categories are used to divide and distribute what is marital partnership property. And so the inheritance aspect aspect is where the Capital Three comes, or the Category Three comes in, and who's then given the capital contribution under that category.
Now, is it your response today that what the judge could have done with that 1.6 was adjusted under valid and considerations? I mean, is that what you said today? Because has that been your position all along?
The family court does have discretion.
I understand that, but I think this appeared both in your answering brief and in the response to the application. It says in assessing the parks in this case, the family court found that it would be just and equitable to give wife a credit of an amount equal to whatever her equalization payment may be. And that's what the court did. Anything more would have violated settled law on the treatment of inheritance in Category 3 assets. Do you mean that the court could not have applied Barks to the $1.6 million?
No, I think that's part of the discretion, but that's what makes this case unique, because the amount of the inheritance is so much more than the modest estate, is any other deviations come from nowhere else but that marital separate property inheritance. And that's
It's no longer marital separate property. You said once it's expended, it becomes Category 3. Why couldn't the VARCs be applied to all 1.6? What would have prohibited the judge, even though you seem to take the opposite position? The judge could have, couldn't it?
Yes, that's
right. Okay, so that's not your statement here. And if the judge could have done that, then explain to me how the judge can apply VARCs to the equalization payment and say, look, we have to adjust things for the wife, and then not adjust it under Category 3. It makes the judge's ruling completely nullified. It doesn't accomplish what the judge set out that the judge was going to do. Said, look, we have to adjust here. But a judge doesn't adjust it. It doesn't touch the 1.6. So what the judge does is nullify the judge's own ruling.
Well, the judge gives to David the capital contribution he was entitled to, but then exercises his discretion in the manner in which he allocates that negative balance and then giving...
There is nothing to indicate that the judge felt or applied anything to the 1.6. It looked like to me when I read this findings is, oh, there's the 1.6. I'm not going to do anything. I'm only going to do it to the equalization payment. There's nothing indicating an exercise of discretion as to the 1.6 for the Category 3.
I think actually mathematically, though, if you subtract the amount, the division of the remainder from the amounts that were related to the capital contribution, he in effect ended up giving David only one half of the capital contribution credit. That was the effect of his overall decision.
Okay. I want to just be sure I understand your position. Is it your position the judge could have or could not have, in essence, divided the marital property, which I think was in the range of about $400,000 to $450,000, even between the husband and wife, and simply indicated that in the exercise of his discretion, he was not going to give credit to the husband for the full amount of the $1.4 million? In other words, as an exercise of discretion, the judge would say, I'm not going to, as we assess what's the fair and just resolution of this matter, I'm not going to give you credit, in effect, for having invested that money into the partnership. Are you saying he could not do that as a matter of law?
No, I don't think so. I think what the family court did was give him, under this court's repeated guidance, the capital contribution to which he was entitled.
I thought I heard Justice Pollack say you were arguing that that would invade the inheritance. So I just want to be sure I understand. Are you saying the judge could not have, in essence, split the marital property evenly in this case?
Had he found it just and equitable to split the marital property evenly, then yes, that was within his discretion. And the calculations, setting aside the end numbers themselves, she actually, because of the equalization payment, ends up with what was divided originally. So it doesn't hurt her the way the negative balances worked out in the end.
That's going to hurt her from the point of view of taking away the interest in marital estate.
I don't think it does, because she ends up with the same amount that the judge allocated to her.
If she didn't have to make the equalization payment, then she may well be free to have the marital property.
Well, that's presuming that the judge would have found it just and equitable to provide her with a division, for example, different than what she asked for. So if you look at the amended property allocation chart and how the actual assets were divided, that's what she asked for. And she asked for the property, and the family court found, for example, related to the marital residence, that it was saddled with such a huge debt that she couldn't afford, that it was just and equitable for that to then go to David, who would be able to afford the debt that was on that. So this specific division is what she asked for in her closing argument.
How can we tell? How can we? I'll let you go.
Well, I just wanted to finish the thought. What do you think was the basis for the decision of the trial court for the required equalization payment of the money?
The basis for the equalization
in the
payment.
The exercising his equitable power. How would you explain that?
The $549,000.
Other than, I assume that the justification is he paid $1.4 million or $895,000, however you calculated, and so he was entitled to get half of it back. But other than that, do you understand why the court came to that conclusion that you should pay that equalization?
I think so. I think it's because, again, based on that general partnership law that the parties share in the debt and the assets, he then allocated it half to each of them.
This isn't purely partnership analysis. I mean, you have the bars that allow the deviation from it. The concept is that you want to try to contribute to the, I guess you could say, the well-being of the marital partners, right? It's not just pure partnership. So that's why I was wondering. But I think you answered my question. It's purely a partnership analysis that she was entitled to, she was required to pay back half of the payment that he made.
And in his discretion in deciding how it was equitable to divide the marital partnership property and take into consideration the capital contributions. I mean, it's hard to look at it in a vacuum at the end result without going through each step. And I think that's a disservice both to this court's case law and the complicated analysis that the trial courts do go through in these types of situations, going through each step and seeing why that was correct under the existing law and then ultimately what that led to.
In that sense, then, summary judgment should not have been granted on whether or not any of this was a gift, correct? But then let me just ask you this. You know, if we follow the logic of this case, we could have a situation, could you imagine, a spouse who is independently wealthy, never works, controls all of the spending, marries someone with no assets, nothing, that doesn't work, and all they do is they live a wonderful lifestyle, and the wealthy spouse says, you know, now someday I expect you to pay me back. This is not a gift. And she controls all of the spending. And then they divorce 35 years later. And under the law, that's all a capital contribution. Pre-trial, the judge rules, you're entitled to all of it back. So therefore, the spouse with no assets owes an equalization payment of half of what was spent during the marriage.
But even under that scenario, the court would still have the ability under the partnership model to take into consideration the fact that he allocated the entire capital contribution.
Is it the issue whether or not it's really a contribution or whether or not it's a gift? Isn't the issue that the trial court should not have ruled pre-trial that this was not a gift? None of this was a gift?
But even if you take away that aspect of the family court's decision, you still end up in the same place from the perspective of how the family court exercised its discretion in allocating the property amongst the parties.
No, I think what Justice McCann is asking you, and what I have been trying to, I guess, get a look at, is that why should a judge have even the discretion at this point? Why are we assuming that when people get married and one spouse has more money and they spend it on living day to day, that 20 years later, Justice McKenna's example said the person said to the person, I expect you to pay. You don't even have to say that under this scenario because the burden, the way the law is, places it on the person who's saying it's not a capital contribution. So we're set up with this situation that a judge 25 years later is given the ability to determine whether or not that we're going to find VARCs to offset this capital contribution. I mean, doesn't that seem a little strained?
I think that's the status of the law because it goes...
I'm not so sure. The law says investment. We're equating expenditures with investment, and I'm not sure they're the same thing. And the other thing I would like to ask you about, you know, we're supposed to be talking about fairness, and usually when people are going to be required to pay someone back for a contribution, I would think there'd be some sort of expectation. Somebody would have some sort of knowledge. Look, you know, we're getting married, and the person has more money, and we're going out to dinner and doing little things faster than the other spouse may. Do you think there's an expectation that the other spouse has that 25 years later they're going to be required to pay back the extra amount of money that was used for lifestyle? I mean, is this logical?
Well, I think that depends on the facts of the case as well, and to a certain extent where those funds are coming from. In this circumstance, they came from inheritance that was kept as marital separate property.
But we keep going on. He took it out of there. He spent it on the family. It was an expenditure. He chose to do it. He didn't have to. He decided, we're going to have a different lifestyle. Kids are going to go to a really good school. We're going to do good things. We're going to do dental implants that we didn't have. And all of a sudden, divorce comes. And, hey, I want everything back.
Which is a different kettle of fish than Wong, right? Wong, where you had, I mean, Justice Pollack's talking about the natural living circumstances that take place when, I guess, one spouse contributes to another from an inheritance. But in Wong, there was an inheritance that was kept separate, clearly kept separate the entire time. And then I guess there was some investment of property as well. But that took on the nature of a clear intent to be able to separate what was initially a separate marital asset and keep it that way. But here, it just loses its flavor.
It's different factually, but it's not different in the way that the principles related to the marital partnership property, the categories and the categorizations of the marital separate property and marital partnership property work. And in this case, those expenditures are used to the benefit of the partnership. If I have a job, and because I have a better position than maybe my husband, and because of that we can eat out more, and we can send our kids to private school, which is a similar situation, those expenditures are still investments into the partnership that we have as a whole, how we live our lives, how we decide to raise our kids. And that's what makes the application of the categories and the principles in this case work out correct under the existing state of the law.
All right, Ms. Copeland, we've used up all your time. I will give you some time in rebuttal, though, since you've been peppering you with questions during the time you'd reserved. Mr. Esser.
Good morning.
Morning.
She got $24,000 in property and alimony for 5 years, which is barely enough to pay housing and medical, and they want the $550,000 back. Now, if this is a proper thing, that Judge Owen was just exercising his discretion and he decided based on all these factors that this is what we should do, then why are they asking you to set aside that portion of his exercise in discretion and give him the, not only the $1.5 million, but also the $550,000 deficit. Now, the concern I have is that I think that what, especially the questions by Justice Pollack and Justice McKenna are focusing on, and to a certain extent, your reference to Wong, is that in Wong, there was still a marital estate left over to divide. What the complaint was in Wong about the separate property was that they ended up with a disproportionate share of property. In this case, wife ended up with nothing. And the concern that we've tried to raise before this court is you don't take a $450,000 marital estate and subtract $1.5 million from it. In partnership law, you subtract the debts until it takes over the assets of the partnership. You don't go outside the partnership and gather the other $100 million from the individual pockets of the people
Actually, under general partnership law, I think it's pretty clear that the partners are responsible to each other for partnership.
The partnership, if it's a limited partnership, only the partnership is liable
but
for
we,
the debts.
But our case law has said we are applying general partnership law, not limited partnership.
Well, let's start with Hawaii law in terms of partnership law, since Gustin. No case has ever held that you can negative a divorce case, turn it into a deficit, and set up an equalization payment that is essentially just paying off a debt. I appreciate what you're saying, but we also understand that partnerships and marriages, as Justice Wilson pointed out, are not the same. And there's simply no authority for creating $1.1 million debt and for doing it essentially arbitrarily. If you look at the judge's ruling, the order we tried, he essentially says these withdrawals came out of that separate account, and therefore they are Category 3. And he made no attempt whatsoever to apply deviation. And I don't think he was exercising his discretion when he did that. What was argued was that he could not do that.
Mr. Esser, we have a question.
While you're on that point, I just want to be clear. So in your view, it is clear that the judge did not consider the expenditure of the inheritance as continuing to be separate marital property. It became part of the marital property once it was expended.
Oh, yeah, right? And in fact, the position we've taken is that the whole inheritance becomes marital partnership property. You can't separate it up. If you look at the Hussey and the Kakanami decision written by the CJ, it clearly says that one of the aspects may be a separate bank account, but another aspect is what was it used for?
Did you dispute below whether or not this was marital partnership property or marital separate property?
Ask again.
Did the wife below concede that this was category three marital partnership property, or did she argue that this was marital separate property?
Oh, no, she argued it was not marital separate property. She said because of the amount spent on the couple and because there were multiple separate bank accounts that before and after during the PEP.
Is there any law that says, case law that says that? Because it's possible that if none of this money was spent, it could have been treated as separate property, correct? Not category three marital partnership property.
That's essentially what happened in Wong, is that it was segregated and kept separate and it existed.
And this was his argument, that I segregated it, I kept it separate, I called it a separate account. Therefore, he argued it was separate property. So in other words, if you start using it, whatever you use becomes marital partnership property, but the corpus still remains marital separate.
I do not believe that. I set the percentage. If you spend 40% of marital separate property, it's no longer marital separate property at all.
And doesn't it depend? I was trying to think this through, and it seemed to me, well, if he spends it on the marriage, then it's not marital separate property, but he spends it on his cars or some, or maybe he sends it off to relatives or something like that, then it retains it. In other words, we're going to have to follow every single dollar to figure out where exactly the money went, to figure out what that specific dollar, how we're going to characterize it. It doesn't seem like that's what was in mind when we set this separate category.
Especially when the pretrial position statement by David says $650,000, and the closing argument says $895,000, as Justice Pollack pointed out. Clearly, there's no confusion about these taxes. These $460,000 was clearly inheritance taxes. That's the reason he didn't even include them in his own argument. I mean, why would the judge reject the argument of David that he only deserved $895,000 in Category 3 deductions and give him literally every penny withdrawn from the account? And there's no explanation as to why he did that. There's no itemization. There's no nothing.
Mr. Esser, what could the husband have done to denominate and make sure that the inheritance stayed separate? Because you're saying that, as long as any money is taken out, it becomes marital property? You're saying that just the fact that it is kept as a separate account is not defining in itself.
I'd make this point. If you're going to claim it's marital separate property, then you don't get to deduct any of it as Category 3. At the time of the robot. That's the difference. That's what happened in Kakanami.
That's different from what you just argued. You just argued the entire amount should be marital.
I understand that, but had spent $300,000 or $400,000 of that, and it was not deducted as Category 3. The marital residence in Kakanawi was divided.
So where did the court go wrong here? You know, we're talking a lot in the abstract about whether this is a just outcome or not. Where exactly did the court go wrong? Is it in the finding that this was not a gift?
I think he did it. The first thing he did is when he decided that he could not apply equitable deviation to Category 3. He decided that before he could apply that at all, he had to deduct all $1.5 million from the marital estate. And then he decided that there was this deficit, and he essentially decided all he could do at that point was
contrary to what Ms. Copeland argued, you think the judge felt he did not have the discretion to reach the outcome?
That's the entire impression. That's what we argued in all our briefs, that he decided as a matter of law that Category 3 comes out of the marital estate, even if it isn't enough to cover it. That he's compelled.
He had no discretion but to deduct the 1.5 or whatever the
correct. Assuming all marks are equal, you get it all back. And what does deviation say? That marks are not equal. But he essentially treated Category 3 as a mandate. He didn't even consider. He didn't say. He decided to waive that payment. So
just to be clear, your understanding is the trial court felt he had no discretion to take the 1.5 off the table, or to say for equitable reasons I'm not going to give a credit to husband for that 1.5 or some portion of it.
That's correct, and the best evidence of that, Your Honor, is what happened. As Justice Pollack said, you find, you know, 10 marks, and then you end up giving them nothing. And I'm thinking, what's the point of creating a deficit and waiving it when she ends up with nothing at the end? That suggests the judge felt his hands were tied, that he could not do anything under equitable deviation.
For purposes of gift, establishing gift, it's the recipient's burden to show that it was a gift. And
that's correct.
And how does one establish that in a situation like this?
That's a good point. And of course, this is mentioned in Paul Tomar.
Is a wife supposed to say, are you giving this to me?
This is mentioned in Paul Tomar's famous article. He thinks that one of the biggest problems with the partnership principle is the way they change Almeida. Justice Wilson's talking about the Almeida case, where there was this presumption for if you give it to you a brother, a son, or a wife. And of course, Judge Burns threw that out and said, no, Almeida doesn't apply.
And what about the presumption under the rules of evidence that money given to another is owed to the other? It's money given is received. You don't owe it back. But we've even gotten rid of that presumption under the evidence code.
And you know, I really don't think there's any Supreme Court opinion that says there's a presumption against gifts. I think that's an ICA ruling. I don't think this court's ever ruled on it. And
they've made the hurdle pretty hard. I mean, burden, you have to show the intent.
Yeah.
And I think it's the long one. Another case says, look, even if you put it in the bank account, that's not enough.
Yeah.
I mean,
Justice Nakayama said there was evidence. Justice Wilson is suggesting clear and convincing or some higher standard to overcome the presumption. If you don't have that, then how do you prove a gift?
But even if you have that presumption, we have David testifying, I believe in this case, oh, I told her a couple times she was going to have to pay me back. So on Justice McKenna's example, you could be married to somebody for 25 years. Maybe once every year you say, oh, by the way. You know? I mean, that's... I'm not sure we should be going down a road that requires people to prove another spouse who are supposedly making a life together and creating a lifestyle, that we should require one of them to prove that the money that's been given, that they have to prove a donative intent.
It's interesting, too, because Justice Nakayama, you took part in Gusson. And as you get towards the end of Gusson, there's a discussion of gift. There's no discussion of overruling Almeida, which was law at the time in the ICA. And it set aside the gift ruling of the trial court. The trial court found no gift. And it was reversed because there was no finding of whether or not there was a donative intent. Now, if you look through the order retrial, there's no findings about donative intent. He just says there's insufficient evidence of a gift. I think if you go back and look at Gusson, and I cited it in the opening brief, it supports reversal because of the inadequacy of the findings on gift. But I think it's very important that we get rid of... But let me get something more fundamental. Let's assume we take this $1.5 million and we carve it down to $500,000 in Category 3. Either we do that with equitable deviation, or we do it with investment or donated intent or anything. My client still would have ended up with zero, because if you subtracted the $500,000 from the $500,000 estate they had left over, she still would have ended up with nothing. It would have been the same result, because by forgiving the deficit, it would have ended up the same. So we really have to look at whether or not, when a judge finds marks, and it's this expression used in Wong, insufficient deviation, it makes no sense to go through the discussion of marks and end up giving one of the parties nothing. And we can talk about all these other matters, whether there should have been Category 1 because of the PEP or not, or whether or not there has to be an investment because the judge found that he invested in his business, not any amounts, but it's there. If you get rid of all those things, you can bring it down. Get rid of the taxes, get rid of all these things, and you bring it down to $500,000. We still lose because it's still deducted from a $500,000 estate. And if those are automatic deductions under Category 3, then the judge can't do anything with equitable deviation. It's just...
Are you asking this court, are you suggesting that this court should consider a presumption?
Oh, definitely.
Or
definitely.
Are you suggesting that we don't even know that it's not an investment? That funds used, if you use inherited funds for your family, it's not, you don't need a tax.
There's a debate in the cases as to what you have to show. And I've raised this in lots of appeals. Normally, the ICA relates by saying no abuse of discretion. But there's a question of whether you've shown that it actually went to marital purposes. That's why this motion for waste was, for summary judgment, was filed by trial counsel. He was looking at those taxes. He was looking at various things and saying, hey, either it's waste, we have no idea where this money went. How did this gentleman spend $1 million, assuming $500,000 was spent on taxes, in 3.5 years? I mean, the jaw work, maybe $30,000, the school, maybe $50,000 or $100,000. Where did the $1 million go? We don't know. And you're absolutely right. It was a separate account, and she had no control over those expenditures, so she has no idea where they went, and there's no evidence in the record where they went.
What rule would you advocate for? That there's a presumption that it is an investment in the marriage, or that it is a gift?
I acknowledge Justice McKenna's point about general partnership law. I think that there's just no way you can create a deficit marital estate with deductions under Category 3 or 1. You just can't. You deduct down to nothing, and then you clearly, you don't go any further. You don't create an artificial equalization payment. Number two, you make it clear that equitable deviation can apply to credits. There's no particular case that says that, and the judge decided that he couldn't. The judge decided that under Category 3, and cases as recent as Kakanami that describe Category 3, say clearly that you've got to give the contributions back. That's like the God. That's like the most important part of partnership principles is 1 and 3. Give back all those contributions. If those are not subject to equitable deviation, that is, in a case like this, it's a useless tool. And it's a very important tool because it essentially pays homage to this thing which you cited recently, CJ, in Collins. Marriage is an equal partnership in which the contributions to the spouse who is primarily engaged in child rearing and homemaking are presumptively valued equally with those of the income earning spouse. Now that's talking about income, not inheritance, but it's essentially the same point. And it's made in Carson in 1967 by C.J. Richardson. It's made in Cassidy. It's made in umpteen cases saying that, and it's especially brought up in the context of PEP and Collins. The interesting thing about the Collins case is it's a PEP discussion. But if you look at the statements in there, they apply to marriage as a whole, not just PEP. They say that non-dollar contributions to a marriage are important. And this Category 3 thing, where you wipe out all those things after a 34-year marriage in PEP, is the problem. Now, there haven't been any questions about the marijuana situation. Well,
can I just come back to, I'm sorry. That's a matter of discretion or as a matter of law. So the $1.4 million as a matter of law should not have gone back to husband, or it's a matter of discretion for the family court, and the family court applied, didn't understand that it had that discretion.
Well, is that a matter of law? First of all, I would say that it is a matter of law. You can't deduct more credits from the marital estate than exists in the marital estate. You can only take it to zero. I would then argue that abuse of discretion under Wong. Wong says, Paul Toma argued in Wong that it's insufficient deviation. In other words, why go through the lining up all these reasons why it's unfair? And keep in mind that all five of the descriptions and categories say if all marks being equal, and then blah, blah, blah. Whenever you find equitable deviation, you essentially negate those five things, which are all partnership principles. And for some reason, the judge treated Category 3 as a law.
But hasn't our cases again and again say Category 1 and Category 3 are the partner's contributions to the marital partnership property, and assuming all valid and relevant considerations are equal, are repaid? You do that first, even before you. Case after case is said.
Yeah. One of the things Paul Tomer says in his article is he knows of no, this was back in 2010, he knows of no published decisions either by the IC or this court that ever set aside a Category 3 or Category 1 contribution. And of course, his argument is that essentially is weighting equitable distribution in favor of the wealthy. And that's what his concern is. Even though if you look at the statute clearly says you can award separate property to the non-owning spouse.
In other words, the wife gets no credit for the child rearing.
That's
for the
absolutely correct.
The only whoever, the husband,
that's
is
right,
providing income gets credit for whatever he puts in.
Yeah.
But there's no value whatsoever.
Yeah.
And we know from all of our tort cases how much that's worth.
Absolutely. And it's not listed in the marks. Look at the judge's finding. That's a place where you could bring it up. You could say, by the way, she raised the two kids. She worked at these schools to reduce their tuition before he got all his big bucks. They went to private school before he inherited
because
she got free. She got free tuition because she worked there. Paul Tomar had an axe to grind because of Wong. You know, he was really upset that he went in there and tried to fix stuff with equitable deviation, and the court turned him down. But I understand that let me say one other thing.
What about the gift thing? Do you want us to address that issue, the question of whether it's a gift or not?
States the law correctly. Justice Wilson certainly supports it, and so do I. He even suggests that it's still the law. It should be the law, and I don't think there's a Supreme Court case that has overruled Amida. I think that's ICA.
Just Wong or did it? Just Wong overruled.
Is Wong Supreme Court? I think that's ICA.
No, I'm just saying Wong, not the Supreme Court, just the ICA.
That's it should be an easy, I don't see any problem with that. And frankly, I don't know what Judge Burns means when he says that Almeida was already sort of no good, and it's completely no good because of partnership principles. I'm not exactly sure why that's true. Because it seems like donated intent is really really an issue unique to marriage, and it isn't necessarily. Partnership principles are useful, but I mean, you can get to a point where you treat that marriage is like commercial partnerships, and you know, you sort of forget what equitable distribution is all about. I wanted to briefly refer to Judge Keene's famous dissent in 1991 in Bennett versus Bennett, which Justice Nakayama was about, because a year later, the Supreme Court took the Bennett dissent and threw out 15 years of USPs. And the reason they threw them out is because what Keene said is that they got in the way of equitable distribution. And the Supreme Court had already made some observations that way. And what they did in Gusset is replace them with partnership principles. And the sense I get is that in the last 18 years since Gusset, is that more and more partnership principles are becoming like USPs. And they are weighted very heavily in favor of the wealthy spouse, especially for purposes of inheritance.
The spouse with the money. No value given to
him. That's exactly right. And right now, the only way somebody like Dorinda can get a piece of the marital estate after had been married 31 years when he inherited. And basically from that day on, based on one interpretation of partnership cases, she had no chance of getting anything. And she has a chance, if you grant the cross appeal, of owing her husband $550,000 more. And it isn't a crazy argument. It's consistent. She's essentially saying that $550,000 was MSP. And you can't, by waiving that, you're essentially giving her MSP. And Hussey and Kakanami say you can't do that. So, I mean, it's a logical argument, but it's also an argument that essentially ignores child rearing and homemaking and all those things. I guess the court has no questions on the marijuana issue.
No.
So it certainly doesn't help me, so I'm not going to go there. but I would say this. I think the reason this case is intriguing to me is because a lot of these problems have been ongoing for years. I mean, divorce cases basically ignore child rearing and homemaking and all those things generally. But in most cases, what it ends up doing is it producing a sort of long result, whereas it ends up in an unfair split, maybe $100,000 to the wife and $250,000 to the husband. In this case, because of the huge amount of the inheritance and the small amount of the marital estate after 31 years, not only does she end up with nothing, the other side is actually in front of you asking for this lady who got $24,000 in this deal to have to pay him $550,000 for the marital deficit. So that's why this case basically shows you what's wrong if you take partnership principles and just sort of apply them across the board without marital considerations.
Justice. Pastor, can I have the luxury of asking you your thoughts about Cassidy? Because you may recall Cassidy was a case that involved a fellow who I guess was in the military, eventually became a general, he found he was keeping his assets separate. And then
he had to make the alimony, and there were two kids, just like here.
Exactly. But the ultimate determination of the court was that there was not separate marital property, and then went ahead and divided the property without any real discussion about the idea of some sort of an equitable contribution that had to be recognized on the part of the wife because the husband had been making payments during the course of the marriage. And so I wondered what your analysis was just in terms of this notion that in Cassidy, at least, it didn't go through the analysis of suggesting that an equitable contribution was necessary.
Cassidy set aside the trial court's ruling, which essentially ended up giving the wife nothing, and cited Carson, which did the same thing, and said that, and I cited Cassidy in the opening brief, and actually I think in the application, because it's so similar. It's a housewife, homemaker, mother, who has two kids and has a wealthy husband. In that case, I think there was also an inheritance. I could be wrong.
There was an inheritance.
And the inheritance is, of course, that was pre-partnership principles. But essentially, under the old USPs, the same thing would happen. in Kakanami last time I was here, and upheld them, said, great law.
Well, there's an important footnote, and I think it was footnote 10, in which there was a point made that if you, the essential point was, if you want to have separate marital property, you have to expressly identify it as such, and in the Cassidy case, because there wasn't a real specific identification of being separate marital property, it wasn't separate marital property, and it became part of the marital estate.
I hear you, but I, you know, with respect, I don't think that's the central issue of Cassidy. The central issue of Cassidy is that is some statement that says you don't judge, you don't divide property up depending on who contributed the most money. That
right.
You have to consider other things. But you know, I understand that ruling. One of the interesting things about Collins in terms of having a separate bank account is Collins addresses that issue with regard to PEP, and there's actually some pretty good language in there. Now, it's not they're not talking there about MSP, but they're talking about something similar, which is PEP, which is are they having a economic partnership or not?
This bank account literally was titled separate, if I recall. In this case, was the bank account literally titled a separate account?
Yes. The same facts as Collins. As Collins said, that essentially, I shouldn't say essentially, I should read it to you. Let's see. Let's write it. Okay, let's see. No, I can't. What the case says is that just because there's a separate bank account, standing alone is not enough to reject a PEP. I would argue that that applies to MSP. And the other fact.
But I'm sorry, in this case, the finding of the trial court was that the husband had, quote, labeled it separate. And
yes.
So does that reflect some greater level of formality or intent on the part of the.
He opened up an account and he put inheritance account. Now, whether the word separate was on there or not, I don't think it was. I think what it was called was inheritance account.
I see.
And he also, like I said, had a separate account for his business, and he also had separate accounts for years. David liked separate accounts, but they also had a joint account, and they paid the inheritance taxes out of the joint account. He wrote the $460,000 check into the joint account. He wrote the tax check out of that. I think that the basing an MSP solely on a separate bank account is junk, you know, whatever. Now, what is suggested in Kakanami that you should also look at whether or not it was used for marital purposes. And then the question is, what do you do if 40% of it was? Do you, my time is up. Do you,
you can wrap up.
Do you make it all MPP or do you treat it as separately? Again, I don't know of any ICA or Supreme Court case where a judge took a inheritance and took some out and used it to wipe out with Category 3 all the marital assets and took the rest of it and said you can't apply the equitable deviation to this because it's marital separate property. Essentially, keeping the non-owner, non-inheriting party from getting anything in the estate. I think I made the argument in my opening brief, so I'm going to stick by it, which is that once you take the majority or a large portion of a separate property and use it for marital purposes, it's not, none of it's marital separate property anymore.
And you were the counsel for the Kakanami case.
I'm sorry, yes, I was.
And there you were representing the husband.
Yes, I was.
The
underdog, I always represent the underdog. and the main thing I point out to you in that case is they split the marital residence.
The
he lost the MSP, but they did not go this Category 3 route.
Right, so you would distinguish that by, I assume, pointing out that in Kakanami there was no such expenditure from the separate marital property.
I wish I could say that, but no, I can't. She actually did spend about 10% of it on marital things, but she didn't subtract it as Category 3. In other words, it was treated as MSP exclusively, and since it's MSP, 3 is a partnership principle. And if you look at Hussey, that open partnership principles only apply to MPP.
And
so
in this case,
so
no
it's
dispute.
Mixing apples and oranges.
Right, there's no dispute that in this case, 1.4 is not MPP, it's marital property.
That's
the
separate
marital.
I don't take yes. And it's also, but there was a motion for recon, and he pushed it up about 1.5, but whatever. In his original ruling,
it's. But it's no longer separate marital property in this case.
That's correct. 40%. And there's one other little factor. And that is the taxes. He subtracted the taxes, or the court did, as Category 3 marital expenses. If you pay the taxes on an inheritance, is it MSP? You're not supposed to use any marital money to support marital separate property. And yet, clearly, if you subtract it as Category 3, you're saying this marriage took care of the inheritance taxes on that MSP. I'm really not
remembering. Thank you very much, Mr. Esser. We'll hear from Ms. Copeland, and, you know, again, we asked a lot of questions of you during your rebuttal time, so can you have some time to respond now, Ms. Copeland?
Thank you, Chief Justice. I just want to make a few quick points. First, under the existing law that exists in the Hussey-Akinami paradigm, it is clear that under the partnership model, each partner is awarded their capital contributions. It's also clear
subject. Isn't it subject to VARs?
You quoted the language, if all valid and relevant considerations taken into account. But the capital contribution itself, in this case, the court decided that he was entitled to that, and he is entitled to that under that case law.
But that's the problem. He said he was entitled, and the law doesn't mean entitlement. What the law says is that assuming all valid and relevant considerations are equal, then it's repaid. That has to be applied first. You don't say that they're entitled and have a findings which don't even discuss it.
Well, and it doesn't describe what the valid and relevant considerations are with regard to how you allocate the capital contribution. Presumably, in this case, it was that it was marital separate property that he then invested and allocated into the marital partnership property itself, at which time it was converted to MPP and he was then entitled to the capital contribution.
What's your response to Mr. Esser's argument that the family court judge believed he had no discretion but to credit the full amount of the $1.5 million to the husband, or return it to the husband as a capital contribution?
Generally speaking, I think that's actually the same argument that we've made, is that he was entitled to that, whether or not the VARC...
No, what did the family court judge think? Was that the family court judge's understanding then, in your view, that he had no discretion to do anything other than to award or view the $1.5 million as appropriately being credited to the husband as a capital contribution?
Honestly, I'm not sure what the family court was thinking. He certainly
isn't
ruled
that a problem?
Trial.
I shouldn't have been interrupted you, but isn't that a huge problem that we don't know what he was thinking? I mean, there's nothing indicating that he felt that he had the authority, nothing reflecting it, nothing showing that, I mean, inferentially, it certainly looks like he felt that he didn't have the authority. And actually, that's what you've argued as well.
And
if that is your argument, that he could not, after applying the parties, use equity to determine that there shouldn't be an equitable contribution, why do you come to that conclusion? Is it based on us?
All of the cases say that a partner is entitled to be awarded back their capital contributions, and that partner's...
Sure, and but again, going back to this idea that partnership principles are useful, but that's not the overriding concept. We're talking about a marriage here, and there are other propositions that are addressed by the motion, for example, which you apply the marks, right?
Right,
how does that case law suggest that equitable deviation wouldn't apply to the credit as well?
Again, I think rather than looking at the end result, it's looking at the whole picture and all of the steps that the family court went through. So the only step that the family court went through wasn't just allocating David the capital contribution credit. He then did exercise his discretion in deviating from that, even though Dorina would have owed him the equalization payment, but he then allocated that debt, that quote-unquote partnership debt, equally. He then gave her the benefit of not not having to actually pay that back. So Dorinda ends up in the same place that she requested she was, she would be originally.
But are you suggesting that the judge actually did feel that he had the equitable power to not only forgive her equitable contribution, but to forgive the entire amount? Do you want to call it forgive, or to just equitably set it aside, the whole 1.4?
Well, I think that's what he ultimately did, because the amount he allocated ultimately to David, David's not actually going to get, and the amount he allocated as a debt to Dorinda, she doesn't have to pay back. So the net result is the same.
If he had found all 1.4 were subject to equitable considerations and not required her to pay back the capital contribution, which is, I'm not so sure it's a capital contribution, but whatever, she would have gotten half the estate.
Well, not necessarily.
Not $13,000.
The calculation in this case as to what amount she got from the actual assets of the estate themselves came before the capital contribution credit, and then after the capital contribution credit, she ends up in the same place. So the valid and relevant considerations, or the just and equitable division and distribution of the estate assets itself, is ultimately unaffected and was unaffected prior to the capital contribution credit being allocated. It was the same division of assets that Dorinda asked for when she asked that David get the residence, that David get the Kahala Cottage, that David get his Camaro, and that I get my car and my IRA.
And $220,000 or whatever it was.
Well, that would have been an equalization payment that could have come from nowhere but David's marital separate property.
Okay, so you are here asking for the $550,000 or so, and you're saying that the $1.5 million is all entirely a capital contribution. And so, therefore, since part of that was to pay for taxes on the entire $3.5 million, you are now conceding that the remaining $2 million is MPP also. Is that right?
No, the remaining MPP was kept in that pristine separate account that is still, was
okay.
Properly.
So you're conceding that was always Category 3 property. $3.5 million was always Category 3.
No, it changed its character based on the application of those categories and...
But you are conceding that the entire 3.5 is MPP?
No. The $2 million that was left in the account at the time of the divorce that had never been touched and had remained in that separate account retained its character as marital separate property, which is...
How could it, though? If you're saying that you're entitled to be reimbursed for the taxes paid on the entire 3.5.
Well, again, I think that evidence was in dispute, and the family court found credible the testimony that he didn't make that determination that the amount within the 1.5.
What was that tax paid?
That $466,000. I don't have the year.
The tax returns are in evidence, as
I
recall.
I apologize. I don't have the year. I'm sorry.
So if marital partnership assets were used to pay the inheritance tax, would that mean that it was the $2 million was no longer marital separate property? Or would that be a factor that would lean toward
it? Automatically converts what was left in the account as marital, that would convert it from marital separate property to marital personal
I thought there needed to be sort of a strict segregation of the use of the asset. So now you're using a marital asset to pay the inheritance tax on the marital separate property. Isn't that now fuzzing the line to the point where it could be argued that the $2 million is now marital partnership property?
I think that would be error in the manner in which the family court allocated the capital contribution credit, but not necessarily legal error in the manner in which the family court characterized the $2 million that was left in the separate
why not?
Property account.
If assuming it was marital assets that were used to pay the taxes, why wouldn't that break down the sort of formality or clear differentiation that we talked about in Kakinami?
Well, I don't think it expressly breaks down those barriers. And in Kakinami, there was evidence that the property was actually joint property deposited into the separate account. And even in that case, this court still held that was correctly designated as marital separate property.
Funded by sources other than marital partnership income or property. So if you pay taxes for the inheritance out of marital property, marital assets, isn't that being funded by a source a marital the marital partnership income or property is funding that MSP, the $3 million account.
I would agree that that could potentially be a factor that would have to be applied, but it doesn't necessarily, I guess, automatically convert that $2 million into marital partnership.
So it's a factor, but not dispositive.
Correct.
All right.
I'm a little unclear as to what relief you're requesting here. You're asking for the $550,000, correct?
Well, I think that issue would have to be remanded to the family court. I mean, the problem in this case, obviously, is that the only thing left for anything to come out of is the inheritance that was properly classified even at the end of the marital separate property. So how that allocation occurs or if the family court will even make the same decision, I mean, that has to go back to the family court for its determination, but
what are you alleging is the error here now? The premarital economic part, the finding of the PEP, is that right?
Oh, the finding of the PEP was error based on the legal analysis that you cannot have the premarital economic partnership based on an illegal business enterprise. Even
the United States Supreme Court ruled back in 1864 that after a partnership against public policy has been carried out and money contributed by one of the partners has passed into other forms, the partners in whose hands the profits are cannot refuse to account for and divide them on the ground of the illegal character of the original contract. In other words, if there's a dispute, but it appears that their marijuana enterprise was profitable enough that they were able to buy a house in Kankakee in cash at one point. So that illegal enterprise has taken another form. If we follow the ICA's logic, how on remand could the trial court try to figure out which portion was and was not related to the original illegal marijuana enterprise?
That's a good question. And I think that would be difficult for the family court to do, especially
if all of it was. If all of the $440,000 originated originally in the illegal marijuana enterprise, if it has to be separated out and that cannot be split, what happens to that?
The impact financially on the divorce itself, if you assume that it couldn't have been the premarital economic period couldn't have been based on the illegal partnership.
Let's just assume that it was, and let's assume that their entire $440,000 marital estate is originated in the marijuana enterprise. Mm-hmm. Okay. What happens to that money?
I don't think that the entire $466,000
estate. Assume okay. That. If so, what happens to the money? Whatever portion is attributable to the marijuana enterprise, what happens to it? Who gets it? Does it escheat to the state? I mean, what happens to it?
I'm not sure, because there is also case law that if it's gained by fraud, it's not divisible and distributed. So I think that that's still possibly then where the family court's discretion would come in dividing the assets that exist on the date of the close of the evidentiary portion of trial versus looking back to tracing when those various amounts came into play. In this case, the PEP didn't affect that bottom line 466 figure so much as it affected to a certain extent the category one capital contributions, but then the family court's discretion in making other decisions such that he looked back the entire 34 years, for example, in allocating Dorinda alimony or those kind of decisions. And so the family court would need to decide on remand how much of that illegal PEP went into consideration for those.
And your client testified when he got the dollars, he put one in one pocket and the other money in the other mm-hmm. pocket or something like that?
For the marijuana business?
Yeah.
No, I don't believe so. But the inheritance was a different amount. I mean, that's not the same thing as the money gained from the illegal marijuana business.
Ms. Copeland, would you like to wrap up at this time?
For all of those reasons, we respectfully ask that this court grant us the relief that we've asked for.
Did you have any other arguments you were able to look up? Very well. So, thank you very much to both of our attorneys. And again, we really want to express our appreciation to the family court and the Waianae District Court. We're very excited to be out here as always, and appreciate all the help and kindness that's been extended to us in helping us set up this oral argument. So at this time, the court will take this matter under advisement.
Please rise. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.
You had a tough time.